Hello and welcome, everyone. It's a brand new year, and you're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Got a brand new year kicking off. I want to remind you, check out Beyond the Darkness, our new episode today, Walking Through Walls, a memoir. Walking Through Walls is Philip Smith's astonishing memoir of growing up in a household where seances, talking spirits, and exorcisms were daily occurrences, and inexplicable psychic healings resulted in visitors suddenly discarding their crutches and wheelchairs or being cured of fatal diseases. We'll talk with Philip Smith today on Beyond the Darkness. But today's true crime episode comes to me via one of our friends and listeners. As I'm always keeping my eye out, I love when our listeners will post what new book they've been reading, what's captured their attention. And as I was looking for a brand new true crime to launch this new season, bam, there it was. Facebook, thank you. And also thanks to our friend Kim. She was talking about this new book she got, how much she loved it. I started reading about it and I was completely blown away. I knew we had to get this author on our show to discuss this. First of all, with her background is fascinating. But this story, Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the Great London Smog, and the strangling of a city. She's with us now, Kate Winkler-Dawson. Kate, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Boy, you've got kind of a nice little pedigree going. You've worked, what, ABC, CBS, Disney,
like all over
Nickelodeon, whatever. You've been there. That's fascinating. What kind of inspired you or intrigued you into the realm of crime and true crime reporting?
Oh, I think it's various things. First of all, who doesn't love a good murder mystery?
True.
I think true crime, it just has always fascinated me. But my background, I think, has really lends itself to exploring it in research. So kind of starting from the beginning, I grew up in a household of attorneys. My father was a law professor at the University of Texas for 37 years, and he specialized in criminal law. So we talked a lot about crime, a lot about defense, and of course there was talk about serial killers and sort of, you know, the depravity part of it, but also the legal background of it all. And so this is sort of the environment I grew up in. I would go to his law classes. And, so really early on, I was exposed to the legalese, criminology, forensics, you know, all of the different ideas that are introduced in court. And so, you know, as I pursued a career in journalism, I just gravitated toward those stories of, you know, seemingly normal people, the man next door who is a serial killer, or, you know, really sort of these varied backgrounds. Particularly, I'm, of course, was interested in people who you just would never suspect that they held these deep, dark secrets. I mean, anything that makes a great crime novel is a story I'm interested in. And I think because of my background, and because of, you know, the reporting I did and when I was a television news producer and all of the stories that I explored, it takes a lot to shock me. And so I really am not going to write a, you know, 335 page book about something that I don't think is startling. And so this book, the combination of The Fog and of John Reginald Christie, the serial killer, I think both of those stories separately intrigued me, but together, you know, they to me were just electric. And so I was so excited about writing it. I mean, you spend 2 or 3 years researching and writing a story. It really has to grab you. And so this did.
I'm always fascinated by people that kind of are indoctrinated into this interest through their family and relatives. I mean, you talk about it just so matter-of-factly as your father was involved in interested in the crime aspects. When you say you guys were talking about serial killers, true crime, all of that, did it not kind of put you off? I find that it either has one of two effects. It really intrigues people, like it seems to do for you and I, or it repels people and they think this is just too much. The darkness is too deep and I don't want to know. I don't want to see. I don't want to read about this.
Well, you know, I on the other side of my family, I think there's an arm's distance that you might take when you grow up, perhaps like in my mother's household, where I look at all of the books that I grew up flipping through in her bookcase that are still there 35 years later. And it's, you know, Dean Koontz and Stephen King and, In Cold Blood. I mean, I was just looking at these books the other day thinking, wow, this really is putting together the pieces for me about how this all came around. But really, it's like sci-fi for me. I mean, why are people crazy about Star Trek or Star Wars? You know, I just saw the new Star Wars. It's great, you know, but I'm not obsessed with it like some people are. But watching, you know, some of the movies or some of the new TV series that are out, that, you know, there are some stories that I just get pulled into and I can watch over and over and over again. And some sci-fi fans might not understand that. So I think it's just, it's all relative.
Well, and you've certainly researched and looked into a lot of cases as you were reporting on them. Were there ever cases that as you're, you know, investigating and talking to people and doing the interviews, were there ever any cases that just left you so icky feeling? I don't know a better word for it than that, that you just thought, you know what, the sooner the story's over, the better.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, certainly anything for me that involves sexual assault and particularly death of children really, I think, was really upsetting. September 11th, you know, I ended up interviewing the mother of one of the people who was on the plane flying over Pennsylvania, who, you know, went into the cockpit, and that was really hard. You know, it's difficult because I think when you're reading through any of these true crime books or any of the cases, it's really easy to focus on the perpetrator and then you forget about the victim. And I find that when I start thinking a little too much about the victims, it's more difficult for me. But when you're writing this book, you have to, you know, in Death in the Air, I really tried to personalize the victims. I tried to pull every detail I possibly could so that, you know, you got to know them and it wasn't a feeling like the reader was sort of dipping into a world and the victims were just used as a plot device to excite the reader because they really liked reading about dismemberment or you know, whatever was happening. I think it's important to know the victim, but it's also a really uncomfortable place to be. And for me, children really is, I have kids of my own. So that's what's hard for me. So yeah, anytime I've sort of had to dig into a case that involves kids, it's made me pretty uncomfortable.
That's interesting. And as somebody who's had to report on this, do you find that maybe the reason the perpetrator gets the highlights, which often seems like a crime in itself, they become famous, they become infamous for the crimes that they do. And the victims, I hate to say it, seem to be forgotten about. Mm-hmm. Or they get put, as you said, as a plot device and, you know, they're kind of the background story. Do you find that that's because when we began reporting on crime, we were trying to protect the families and survivors of the victims, and that without exploring too deeply their background or fleshing them out as a human, you know, it kind of kept them somewhat safe and somewhat, you know, locked in a moment in time for families so that's what their memory was? Do you think there was any kind of journalistic integrity involved in doing that? Or is it just, you know, people want to know about the dark side of it. They want to hear the dark and creepy and that's the killer.
Well, so I would love to be optimistic and say that what you're saying was right, that, you know, this was sort of, we're you know, trying to create distance between the reader of a newspaper or a book and the victims' families. Unfortunately, just in my research, that's never been the way journalism has worked. You know, I've been reading up on a case that I really love, and it's from the 1800s, and there are plenty and plenty of people who were willing to talk about the victims. The victims were two women and two little, you know, babies, basically infants. But the killer was so fascinating and brilliant, and he was so outlandish, and he was the antithesis of what the sort of gentleman was during this time period. That's all people wanted to read about in the newspapers. I mean, they were obsessed with this man. And so it became very clear that, you know, it would be someone who was reading this Gilded Age newspaper would be hard pressed to remember the name of his victims at all, not because of some some sort of, you know, respect that the journalists really tried to, you know, use to protect the victims and the victims' families, but just they weren't as interesting. You know, this is, you know, two women, two country women and two little children. And it's very hard to, it's hard to take the attention away from a, you know, a really fascinating, genius killer. And so that to me, this case that I'm looking at now is really something that, epitomizes just how low journalism can go. And again, this is a hundred and something years ago. So there's not a great precedent for journalists behaving well when it comes to murder. But I do think it bleeds, and we have sort of this, view of how horrible journalism is now and how different it must have been, you know, in the good old days. And, that's not been the case of everything I've read.
You know, it's interesting because we talk about the way that the victims are slighted. And it's because, let's face it, most of the time their stories are non-extraordinary.
Right.
Right. But then you think about murders and you think about victims. And then I can name off Marianne Nichols, mm-hmm. Annie Chapman, Elizabeth mm-hmm. Stride, Catherine mm-hmm. Eddowes, and Mary Jane Kelly. And most people know those are the victims of Jack the Ripper.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wonder, is it because they were notorious in the fact that they weren't just mothers, they weren't just, you know, storekeepers, they were prostitutes. So there was that kind of seedy underbelly of what they had done, which made them almost, sadly to say, this is interesting as the killer. Do you think that that's why we recognize names like that? Or, you know, unfortunately, then you get names like, you know, the Folger heiress and Sharon Tate and, right. you know, the names like that because they were public figures. They were part of the lexicon of society at that time. So there was a backstory for each one of them.
Yeah. And I think, with the Jack the Ripper victims, I think it's just repetition. I mean, we've heard about this story for, you know, more than 100 years. So I think, I don't know if many of my friends would know, I guess some of my friends who are into true crime would be interested in it, but I'm not sure the average person who knows who Jack the Ripper was would be able to still name off his victims.
Are you just calling me a nerd? Is that what you're because I just named them off? Is that kind of a little bit of a slight there? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Brilliant. I meant brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got you. All right.
Savant with true crime. No, but I do think, you know, I am not a Ripperologist or anyone who is particularly fascinated with the Jack the Ripper case any more than probably anyone else is who really considers himself a true crime aficionado. But, I'm not even sure if I would remember all of the names, of his victims, but it's so interesting because, you know, someone like Sharon Tate, right? I mean, she was a part of culture. And I think that Charles Manson just elevated her into this other realm because I would have never known who Sharon Tate was. I mean, this was far before my time, with Manson. So I just don't, I think that it's, I guess, a case by case basis, but I really think with Jack the Ripper, I'm not sure if it's because, you know, they were prostitutes. I think they just fit into the lore and it's, you know, part of the thread. You know, when we talk about that case, it's just been repeated so often. So, I mean, I think it's probably like a Sherlock Holmes novel where people know who Moriarty is and, you know, who Watson is, but they've never read any of the books. It's just sort of part of that culture. But certainly, so I'm reading about a case now, that's sort of unfolding in front of me where I'm kind of considering a second book. And it's sort of a Sherlock Holmes mystery case, except it's a real life case. And it's about a woman whose body parts were found in 1920s California, and there were some parts found in one area, and then the rest of her body was found 12 miles away. And it's about the detective who made the connection and was able to kind of guide people, investigators, to the other side. And so I'm thinking, this is a great case. But I mean, literally about 3 hours ago, I was reading more into it, and I'm finding out more about the woman. So they were able to identify the woman, but they were never able to find the killer. And she was killed in a really brutal way and chopped up and kind of spread out everywhere. But I'm finding out more about her, and I'm finding myself changing my tone about the case, and it's a little upsetting for me. So maybe you and I can work through this together. So she apparently was involved with multiple men. And she was extorting money from them by telling each one of them that they had children who they didn't have with her. And so, you know, they had up to 8 suspects because she was heavily involved with 3 men, but sort of doing this with many men. And, you know, one would presume statistically that one of these men was the one responsible for killing her. But no one was ever arrested. And this case has been, you know, long gone for 80 something years. But I just, thinking about the victim, thinking, you know, there's not a part of me that said, well, you know, you're kind of asking for it. But I think we get that in society sometimes. It's kind of like, well, you put yourself in a bad situation and this is what happens and no one deserves to be murdered. But I have to kind of wrap my head around, you know, what she might have done to contribute to all of this. And I think that as a journalist and as a, you know, a crime investigator, I think that, you know, we're all kind of in that same role where you really, there are many times when the victim, you know, does play into all of this. And so that makes it, it makes it strange to look at a case and just kind of think, okay, well, you know, did she participate in this somehow? What should she or could she have done differently? But does that even matter if, you know, in the case of Jack the Ripper, if his victims are prostitutes, did, you know, does that make them any less worthy of, you know, their murders being investigated? So it certainly complicates things when you concentrate on the victims. And I think that sort of plays into why it's easier to just focus on the Looney Tune killer who none of us could imagine, you know, is an ex-store neighbor or a relative or ourselves.
Yeah, it is rough when, and I'll talk to you off air because I have an idea on something perhaps you and I should work together on, but it is tough when you look at the crime angle of it, and we have these compartmentalized ideas of a crime and who the victim is. And when you start realizing there's aspects to the victim that seem seedy or, you know, out of it, you know, not, it's not a clean cut. This person was just murdered because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, or, you know, they left their front door unlocked or something. You start to realize then it that's where that gray line comes in, right? What, not that anybody deserves to die, but what part does the victim play in some of these situations? And are they putting themselves in harm's way? Does that make it any less of a tragedy? Or is that what magnifies the tragedy, that this whole snowball effect happened and how life turns and, you know, our decisions can snowball into these massive consequences?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that, you know, in my case, when I read those sort of details, it gives me a little distance between me and the victim, which I think is probably not such a bad thing. But I think, you know, just like when you're writing about true crime and you're writing about a killer in particular, you know, you end up having, as a writer, you have a relationship in some ways with everyone in the book. And so, you know, for me, for Death in the Air, with this particular book, as the book moved forward in the life of John Reginald Christie, the serial killer, there were times when it was probably pretty clear when I was writing from his point of view, where I felt sorry for him. He was a pretty pathetic character in many ways. But then, of course, you know, when you really get to the lives of these women and just so how blasé he was about killing them and keeping their bodies in his house and in his garden, how disgusted, you know, how disgusted I could feel But I think that I steer clear from characters, from people and cases that are clear cut. Cause those are no fun for me. You know, it's like the white knight and the man dressed in black, and there's good and evil, and that's the end of it. And that's not the way crime usually works. It's certainly not the way the world works. So I like really strange, messy stories where, you know, for instance, John Reginald Christie, the serial killer in the book, had a sort of difficult childhood. He had a rough go of it. He grew up in a sort of abusive household, with his father being physically abusive, and he had a overbearing mother and several overbearing older sisters, and you know, he was sort of forced to do almost everything. And, you know, as he got older, he had self-esteem issues, which led to problems with girls. And the girls were very vocal about the problems that he had with sex, and that embarrassed him. And, you know, consequently, he had a pretty bad social life. And then he went into World War I and was gassed and ended up with a squeaky voice. So, you know, he didn't have a great start, and he was a sort of an awkward man. So he's a really pathetic person in many ways, but also fascinating because he was so incredibly smart. And so in some ways I felt not in awe of him, certainly not, but I was fascinated, I think, with the way his mind worked. And then, you know, at the same time, it's disgusting what right. he would do to people. So I think it's all very complicated, and I like that. I don't want to feel, you know, I would never want to go into a book having a very clear idea of the person, whether it's a victim or the killer, or even the historical era that you're going into, because it's all very messy. And I think that's what makes it, gives it depth and makes it so interesting.
Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the great London smog, and the strangling of a city. Kate Winkler Dawson is the author of the book. And boy, it must be good, because you have one collectible copy available on Amazon for $937.50, Kate.
What? Are you serious?
Would I kid you?
Are you going to buy it?
Of course I will. Yeah, 937. It's got to be good. It's a collector's edition. It's funny. Yeah, that's a great price point. Holy cow. Somebody has definitely enjoyed your book and thinks it's worth quite a bit of money.
I'll sign it for anybody who wants to buy that book. I'll sign it for you. I'll take you out to dinner, actually.
Holy cow. All right, here's my question for you. As we look at a case like this, and you're looking at a case that is winter of 1952. We're in 2017, 2018. When you start researching a book like this, how hard is it to find really good, solid information regarding the aspects of this case? Were they pretty good at keeping, you know, documents and the history? I know the book reveals a lot that has never been mentioned or released before.
Yeah, and I think about both sort of the cases, if we consider the fog a case also. There was an awful lot of documentation, I think about both of them. Particularly the British love to keep records, mm-hmm. and they love archives, thank goodness. So they had a fantastic archive in the National Archives, which is in Kew Gardens, where I spent an awful lot of time frantically taking photos of every file I possibly could. So, you know, when at the end of this whole sort of research process, I would guess somewhere between 800 and 1,000 pieces of paper, photographs, something from both of these cases, just from the National Archives. So that was an extraordinary amount of information to synthesize. So I also, just, you know, looking forward with other books and just in projects, I have a little bit of a checklist, and it's relevant to what we're talking about for what I think is a good book for me to write. And, you know, so my idea of true crime, when I say true crime, I am unlikely to write a book that is sort of a Ted Bundy or a Jeffrey Dahmer. I think those are very valuable, but I like true crime in history. So historical true crime that, you know, that really shines a light on an era, on a time period, on, you know, something about a culture, something about our history. And so when I'm looking for that type of a story, one of the number one check marks for me is it has to have a lot of source material, firsthand source material. I don't want to go to other books, other biographies. And I will occasionally for analysis, but I really need a diary, a memoir, confessions. Lucky for me, when we're talking about unscrupulous journalism, lucky for me, part of what I talk about in the book is this phenomenon called checkbook journalism that they had in 1950s London, which were there was a group of newspaper journalists, all men, who were nicknamed, I think it was the Murder Squad. And they were the crime reporters, and they were sort of rock star celebrities, and they would offer money to defendants to pay for their defense if they could secure their confessions or their statements exclusively for the newspaper. So in John Reginald Christie's case, Harry Proctor, who was with the Sunday Pictorial in London, offered the most money. He paid for his defense, and in exchange, John Reginald Christie gave some of the most interesting confessions I've ever read of any, certainly any killer in the 50s, because they were printed, and it turned him into this star. And for a man who had this sort of pathetic existence to begin with, having all of this media attention was really what he craved. And so it instantly turned him into the criminal celebrity and turned this into a trial for the decades. And so that was really important to me, that Christie gave multiple statements. His wife gave multiple statements. Witnesses, you know, the Metropolitan Police had incredible records of all of the witness statements. The trial transcripts were available. They were available online and also, you know, in person at the National Archives. And then the National Archives have preserved the newspapers like the Sunday Pictorial that were no longer in existence. And I couldn't just go to newspapers.com and pull those off. So there was an awful lot of source material, and I would never be able to write a book based on just newspaper clippings. I don't think I don't think you could get characters like that. And I really need firsthand accounts. I need the personal eye to be able to use quotes to create dialogue that, you know, is not created as it exists, but I need to be able to build this world with facts only. And it's difficult to do that if you don't have the right source material. So yes, thank goodness that the British love preserving history.
I want to then kind of look at the two stories that are taking place here, and we'll get into his story and the serial killing aspect of this, but set the feel for us of that time. It was December 1952, correct?
Right. December 1952. So, you know, we're talking about post-war London. So it's 7 years after the end of World War II. And it's a city that's literally shell-shocked still. So it had been bombed. There were sort of the carcasses of buildings that were never able to be rebuilt. Neighborhoods have been destroyed. And, you know, there was low unemployment that was starting to pick up because the government was desperately trying to build a record number of homes to house a lot of homeless people. And so it was a city sort of in flux. The next summer would be the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. So there was a lot of optimism. But, you know, it was a difficult time period in most of the neighborhoods in the city. You know, minus some of the posh areas, most of the neighborhoods, you know, there were people who were still struggling to find work or they were underemployed. Crime was high. The police force was undermanned and sort of overwhelmed. And so, it was a difficult city to live in at the time. And very dirty. And that's where the London fog came in. So in December of 1952, there was a time when the government December 1st, the government decided to lift the rations on this cheap coal. And coal was the predominant heat source in London. It was the only thing that was realistic at the time. And coal had been rationed since before the war. So the government lifted the rationing on this particular type of coal, and it was called nutty slack. It was brown. It was crumbly. It had about a third less heat than black coal. But the government said, listen, winter's coming. It's very cold. Come and buy as much as you want. So on about December 1st, people set out in droves and bought this coal because it was supposed to be a very cold week. And in fact, it did turn out to be the coldest week of the year thus far. And so 4 days later, you had more than 8 million coal grates burning coal for people in private homes and businesses around the city, and a anticyclone, which was a high pressure system, floated over the city and sat there for 5 days, and it trapped pollution. So again, to set the scene, you're talking about the most populated city in the world with more than 8 million people in a very small space. This is also the most industrialized city in the world. So there were 40 coal-fired power plants just in London. And there were more than 20,000 coal-fired steam locomotives that sort of circled London in the area. There, of course, were also millions of cars. And the city, the summer before, had discontinued its electric tram system and replaced the trams with those beautiful red double-decker buses that are fueled by diesel. So an incredible amount of pollution, which always created lots of dirt, lots of grime, lots of fumes, lots of bronchitis, respiratory issues. That was part of living in the city. It was just an unfortunate byproduct. And so every winter, you know, these anticyclones would float in, and they would create a lid over the city, sort of like a canning jar lid, and it would trap whatever pollutants were floating in the air at the time. But eventually, within a day or even a few hours, a little low pressure system would come in and blow away the high pressure system, and everything would get back to normal. And that's how you end up with those classic London pea supers with the really yellow, thick stench, which is what London's known for. And in this case, this high pressure system didn't leave for 5 days. There wasn't a breeze of wind. Nil is what the meteorological records I found said, no wind. And so you're talking about an incredible amount of pollution sitting in London and not moving for 5 days straight. So within those 5 days, I think it was around 2,000 people died just within those 5 days. And then the number kept increasing and increasing. And eventually the government admitted that between December 5th, when the fog started, and the end of December, so about a 3-4 week period or so, 4,000 people died. But the trick here is that more people died later on because of the smog. You know, if you have bronchitis or pneumonia or heart failure, you don't die immediately. They stay in hospital, they suffer, sometimes they get better, then they get worse, but doesn't mean that their deaths are not attributed to the fog. But the British government said, nope. If you died after December 31st, you didn't die from the smog attack. So in reality, what, you know, researchers found out about a decade ago was that the people who died between January 1st and about March 7th, March 8th, we have an additional 8,000 deaths that were beyond the norm. And the British government claimed that they actually had succumbed to a influenza epidemic, which absolutely never happened. So the kind of grand total of the people who died from the Great Smog of 1952 is about 12,000. And at 4,000, which is what the government had initially admitted to, was still the world's deadliest air pollution disaster, and still this caused no panic. This was just part of living in London, known for its smogs, and this one just stayed longer than normal. And, you know, and this was very much a stiff upper lip. Let's push forward. We survived the Blitz. Let's keep moving forward situation. So it was very startling to read about all of the deaths and the people who died, and read all of the internal memos between the Ministry of Housing and the Ministry of Health, and how, you know, they were trying to blame each other, essentially. And sort of the callousness really is what struck me, the callousness of the government towards these people who died. I have a memo in which, in sort of polite British speak, someone from the Ministry of Health says, well, these people were all going to die anyway because they were older than 60 and were in poor health.
Then they totally had it coming.
Well, right. I mean, you know, well, let's clean house. So, I mean, and can you imagine? It's just, when I read that, it's so disgusting. It's, you know, I mean, it's an apathetic government, which is just as culpable as, you know, an active government, you know, pushing heroin to people. I mean, it was really setting the city up for disaster. And that's what happened. And there were so many people who died, just horrible deaths. And the government did nothing. And the following November is what really was startling for me because, you know, as anyone would expect, oh, here comes another winter, here comes another fog. We know it's going to happen. And so I started noticing the memos, the closer that the memos would be dated toward the fall, the more kind of sort of panicky they became. And they started testing masks that they were going to, issue to people who had bronchitis. So hopefully if there was another smog, this wouldn't happen again. And they tested masks. And so I have all of these memos about the effectiveness of these masks. And the Ministry of Health says they're not effective at all. There's nothing effective about them. You can't stop fumes. And they still issued them. And they charged a prescription fee on top of it. And they did no good. You might as well put, you know, gauze over your face. And so it's so interesting how governments react in that situation. But I think, you know, when I combined these two stories, which is of the fog and of the serial killer, you know, one of my points, my biggest point is to just show how this serial killer really kind of covered this whole situation up with the fog, because he dominated the headlines right when there were debates about air pollution. And I, you know, who wouldn't rather read about this loony serial killer who was on the run, who had bodies in his kitchen and under the floorboards and in the backyard? I would certainly much rather read, you know, these incredible headlines that say Murder House and Beast of Rillington Place. Then, you know, it's easier to be worried about a clear and present danger like a serial killer on the run than a systemic issue that would take decades to solve. And that's what air pollution was. It was a systemic issue that was really going to take money and time and perseverance to make any sort of headway. And I think that this was just not a situation where the British government was willing to do that. So I think it became, for me, very much a narrative that plays out today. Every time we have a politician who tweets something that is inappropriate or outlandish, we are completely derailed in the media and in the public. All of a sudden, we forget about North Korea or criminal justice or, you know, what's happening with the EPA. I mean, there's so many large systemic issues happening that are problems that need to be solved, but we are derailed by sexy stories or, you know, attention-grabbing headlines. And that's just exactly what happened 65 years ago.
Well, and it also has to be, right, at this point, what can we do about it? So, right. You know, it's easier, and I wonder if that was kind of the smoke and mirrors of the government as well. You know, play up the serial killer thing more. Play this up and talk about it. You know, media, well, this is something we can sell papers for. Nobody wants to read, oh, by the way, you're probably going to die. You know, there's a good chance that the smog is going to wipe out a good portion of you this year. You know, that makes for bad newspaper sales, right? And I don't mean to sound flippant or cavalier, but I'm thinking marketing-wise, there had to be some background discussions of, you know what, we really need something else to find. And I wonder if that leaped in. All right, so now that was December 5th, 1952, correct?
Right.
Krampus night. You think there's a correlation?
I don't know.
Krampus coming to clear the way? All right, so this begins, and talk to me a little bit about this killer. You gave us some insight on him and the kind of life and personality that he was. But at what point in his life does it go from just kind of having a string of bad luck and bad attention given to you to, you know, and this is what I think fascinates me, is you read about these serial killers and you hear, okay, there was sexual abuse, there was physical abuse, there was mental abuse, there were things in their lives that I bet most people could look at in their own lives and go, hey, you know, I lived through that. Why didn't I flip? What's the difference between this guy and Darkness Dave Schrader? Why has that switch not flipped yet? Why am I not a serial killer? What's that line? And I think maybe that's what people are so fascinated by when it comes to zombie movies and serial killers, right? Because it could be anybody at any time, and there doesn't seem to be a rationale to what makes them become a killer.
I mean, I think that's true. Certainly, John Christie had a string of bad luck and some unfortunate circumstances, but certainly people long before him had far worse luck and didn't react in the same way. I think that probably there's, I'm not a shrink, but I think there's certainly some sort of a personality disorder. I don't know about maybe a mental illness, you know, I don't know, within him. But essentially what happened was he was never violent. He smacked one of his girlfriends in the back of the head with a cricket mallet. I know I just said he wasn't violent, but, you know, as far as attacking women, and he said that it was an accident and he was trying to show his,
he was trying to get a mosquito. What?
He was trying to do a demo on how to play cricket. But, that was one thing. But, you know, moving on, he was married for many years. His wife never reported any sort of violence against her. He was meek. He was physically weak. He just always had my doctor would say a bad constitution. He really always had aches and pains and flatulence, and you know, he constantly had
wait a minute. Are you
issues.
I think you're just reading my bio right now. Knock it off. my new wife is going to start getting real nervous when she hears this interview.
Lots of problems, lots of physical problems, which is not ideal for a serial killer, obviously. And
it's not ideal for anybody, right?
And it's funny, is, you know, with the way this book is structured, is about a third of the book at the beginning, when the fog hits, John Christie is just another person who's really suffering in this fog. His wife wrote to her sister and said, "This fog is unbelievable. It's making us all sick. You know, we can't leave the house," which of course is horrible news for a serial killer who just wants to get away from his wife. And she used to travel to go see her sister, but her health was failing and she was very needy. So I think that the walls sort of began to come in on him. The first encounter that he had with a woman where he murdered her, he had always sort of frequented prostitutes. I mean, I think he found that with prostitutes, it was the only way he could perform. He had been horribly humiliated in his youth by girls who sort of judged him publicly on how he was in the sack. And he certainly did not come off very well. So in 1943, he was a war reserve policeman and actually looked pretty good in uniform from the pictures I've seen of him. And in the area where he lived, which was Notting Hill, and Notting Hill in the 40s and the 50s was not such a great place. I mean, it was high poverty, a lot of prostitution, a lot of crime. The police there worked, you know, overtime all the time. And he patrolled the streets during the war. And he met a lot of women, so he frequented a lot of prostitutes. And then he met a woman named Ruth First, and they had an affair. And as I said, Christie's wife would go and visit her sister out of town in Sheffield. And so she would be gone for 5 or 6 days at a time. And she would always send him a telegram to let him know when she would return to London. So he had this flat, which was a decent little flat for London, on Rillington Place. And he had this flat to himself for days at a time. She would go frequently. And so he knew he could safely bring women back, and he would bring Ruth First back. And they would have sex. And he claimed in one of those exclusive confessions to the Sunday Pictorial I told you about, that she sort of fell in love with him and he said, no, but let's have one more roll in the hay. And when they did, he spontaneously strangled her during sex. Ooh. And he liked it. And he didn't seem to panic. It was just something that, you know, was spontaneous, and they were probably having rough sex, and it just, some switch flipped. He said that in his youth, when his grandfather died, that he stood and stared at his grandfather's dead body during the service for a very long time, and he just found he found dead bodies to be very peaceful. So he wasn't at all repulsed by them. So that was interesting. And I think that he really felt probably like he disassociated with a lot of women. I think he cared for his wife, but I think he probably had that sort of antisocial personality disorder. If I was going to categorize him, I think that's probably what it would be, where he distanced himself and it was very difficult for him to have relationships that were meaningful with women. And so then he realized that he really enjoyed this. And the women who he ended up killing were virtually all prostitutes. And so I think that was even another layer of distance that he could put himself between these women and what he was doing and himself. But it's so curious because he buried two of them in the backyard, three of them inside his kitchen, and then he eventually killed his wife.
Whoa. Wait a minute. How do you bury three people in your kitchen?
Well, so this is where...
Do you blame the smell on a backed up garbage disposal? I mean, that's not something you can hide.
You know, my editor and I talked about this. This is what was so interesting, is it was in London, and particularly in the backyard, these were really good conditions to bury bodies. They were cold and they were dry. So there was not that overwhelming stench of rotting flesh as much as there could have been. He didn't turn the heat on in the apartment. So he had two women in the backyard, and he had buried, let's see, one was in 43 and one was in 44. So he killed, you know, two women about a year apart. He buried plants above them, and he kept a garden over them in the backyard. I mean, he really, it was incredible. So there, his dog liked to dig, and a couple of years after he buried both of these women, the dog dug up a skull of one of them, and he freaked out and took the skull and tossed it into a bombed out building. And the skull was found later on, much later on. But the dog also dug up the femur bone of his first victim, so the thigh bone. So Christie picks up the thigh bone and looks at part of his fence, which is falling down, and he takes the thigh bone and straps it to the fence to keep it from falling down. So it becomes of practical use for him. I mean, who does that? It's amazing. I mean,
oh my God.
Talk about disassociation. I mean, it was really like, and then the police came looking for, in a totally different case, came looking for the dead body of a woman and her daughter, and they walked right by this bone holding up a fence, just like a strange shaped post. And so, you know, this is a pretty extraordinary man who then killed his wife and buried her under the floorboards of their parlor. And one of the sort of creepiest scenes for me was, you know, one of the characters is a man named Lim Trevelyan, who is a police officer who investigated Christie and met him.
And just let me clarify for our listeners, when she refers to a character, she's not meaning, this is not a novel, folks. This is just one of the people that is part of this real story. So I just want to make sure people don't realize or think that we're talking about a murder mystery novel here.
Right. Sorry. I call them characters.
No, I get that. And I understand that. I just know I'm going to get emails from people that'll be like, I thought this story, this radio show is only about true crime, not about novels. So I always clarify where I can for the people that sometimes don't follow along as clearly as I hope they would. All right, so good. So this introduce us to this fellow again. Who is this?
So this man is Lynn Trevelyan. He's a police officer who is investigating the Christie case. And he encounters Christie twice and ends up at his house several other times. And so Lynn Trevelyan, the police officer, is chasing I call him a biscuit bandit, a man who ran into a bakery and grabbed a tin of biscuits and ran out. And Lynn Trevelyan was patrolling Notting Hill at the time and went, you know, gave chase and ran after the man. And the man ran into John Christie, the serial killer's building, and ran up the stairs. And Lynn Trevelyan caught him. It was one of Christie's neighbors, walked him back to the police station. And then Lynn Trevelyan goes back to 10 Rillington Place and proceeded to knock on the doors of all the neighbors to explain why they had arrested one of their neighbors. And he knocks on Christie's door and Christie says, sure, come on in. And he invites him in. And Lynn Trevelyan says, you know, it really smells badly in here. And he said, Christie said, well, you know, I have these neighbors and the food really smells badly and it's Caribbean. And you can't even believe the smells that come in here. And Lynn Trevelyan, a police officer, thought nothing of it and left. And when Christie was arrested, Lynn Trevelyan was assigned to go and watch him eat food and put him on suicide watch in prison. And Lynn Trevelyan walks into Christie's cell and Christie smiled at him and said, I recognize you. You know, when you asked me about that smell, you probably know what that was. You were standing right over my wife. So that's the kind of guy we're talking about.
Wow. Isn't that frightening? I mean, the cops were right there. This is like something out of a Columbo murder mystery, right?
It is.
Yeah. That the cop is standing right over the top of this decomposing body. What brought him to the point of finally murdering the wife? Just couldn't take it anymore?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was interesting because one of the things that it seems different from Christie is that he did go on hiatus quite a bit. So his first killing was the woman he was having an affair with was in 1943. And then he killed another woman about 7 months later named Muriel Eady, who was just a coworker. She wasn't a prostitute. She was just a coworker. And she killed him. He killed her in 1944. That was the one who he used to develop his technique. And so his technique was he talked to Muriel. She said, I have a really bad cough from all of the smogs that have been happening, and I have bronchitis. And he said, I have a cure for that. Come to my house. My wife's out of town. I can, you know, give you this medicine. I have this breathing apparatus. And so when she comes to the house, he hands her a rubber tube to put over her face. And the tube is connected to a glass jar that has some liquid in it. And it's Friar's balsam, which is this sort of like, I think, menthol smelling stuff that helps clear out your lungs. And there was some water in there. And she starts breathing it in and she goes unconscious because she never noticed that on the other side of this glass jar is another tube that's connected to the gas tap on the back of his oven. And it had coal gas running through it. So it completely disabled her. And he used this on the last three victims. So on four out of the six people he killed, he used this method. And so he killed this woman, buried her in the backyard, and then just used prostitutes for several years. There's a very controversial case in the middle of what I guess you could consider wasn't a hiatus. In 1950, he had two neighbors move in with their little girl, Timothy Evans, and Burl Evans was the wife, and then they had a little girl named Geraldine. And the wife and the little girl went missing, and the husband confessed. And these are the Christie's upstairs neighbors. And the husband confessed, and they couldn't find the bodies anywhere. And then he recanted and said, actually, John Christie did it. My neighbor killed them. I didn't kill them. And they found the bodies later on in the wash house in the backyard. And John Christie said, I didn't kill anybody. And, of course, nobody knew he was a serial killer. He testified against his neighbor. His neighbor was convicted and hanged. And then 2 years later, they start pulling bodies out of 10 Rillington Place and realize, well, maybe John Christie actually killed the neighbor's wife and child, and we ended up hanging the wrong person.
All right. Well, so, hold on 1 second, though. You know, your child and your wife die.
Right.
You think your neighbor did it. Would you just coexist? Yeah, it's just my stupid neighbor. It's one thing to maybe he broke your window or ran over your favorite flower with his lawnmower. But he killed my wife and kid, but geez, they wouldn't shut up one night. I can hardly blame the guy. I mean, what is the rationale? No wonder that was a fact. Do you think that he, Christie, was behind these murders as well, or do you think it was the neighbor?
Oh, I think it was the neighbor.
One building alone, you've got two murderers living on top of each other.
And I'm one of the few people who probably believes that. And I think it's just because of the evidence. So nobody in the 50s believed that there could be two killers living in the same building at the same time. Now, two serial killers is a little far-fetched. But one serial killer and a wife beater who lost his temper and killed his wife and his kid, I absolutely believe it. Especially in the 50s, you know, there was so much unemployment and kind of misery in that neighborhood. It was a really dim place to live. And so I absolutely, he was abusive, and I absolutely believed he was the one who did it. I think that the police had so many problems. Number one, of course, walking right by that femur bone, they weren't focusing on finding dead women in the backyard. They were focused on finding a little girl and the mom. And incidentally, there was such a confusion with the Metropolitan Police about where to search that they never searched the wash house where Burl Evans and Geraldine Evans were actually stored. One cop thought the other one had searched it. So they were in there for 3 or 4 extra days without anyone knowing it. It was a real Keystone Cops situation. They never did a rape kit on the neighbor's wife, on Burl Evans. So, you know, as we know, Christie's main motive was sexual assault. He would disable these women, he would sexually assault them, and then he would strangle them. And he did that with everyone except his wife. And with the wife, he just strangled her. He never disabled her. He strangled her one morning. I think he had just had enough. I think he had been stuck with her in that fog for 5 days. Her complaints about the neighbors who were from the West Indies were growing more and more intense. He was really feeling physically poorly, and he had created sort of this intense relationship with these local prostitutes. He fancied himself as an amateur photographer, and so he did a lot of photo shoots with these two women. And I think it just kind of teed him up for wanting to have freedom. His wife was not leaving. She had poor health, and he strangled her one morning and put her under the floorboards, and that was it.
Boy, if he's gassing people and the smog is killing people in a very similar manner, wouldn't it have just been easier for him to wipe these people out and then go leave the bodies somewhere where people would just assume they died from the smog inhalation?
Well, listen, I mean, how many buildings do you think that are bomb sites? He could have dumped them anywhere, and people would have just assumed that they were perhaps bombing victims. I mean, there were plenty of places for him to dump bodies. He made a very clear choice to keep these bodies close to him. So an answer to your question from many moons ago, how do you manage to stick three people in a kitchen? He had a coal cupboard that he never used. He pulled the boards back from the cupboard. He put these women in as he killed them. So he killed kind of one a month in 1953, January, February, March. And he would seal each one back in. So they were all shoved in together. And then he finally ran out of room in the kitchen, and he ran out of money. He couldn't pay his rent anymore, so he went on the run. And the reason they were found is because his landlord – well, first of all, he illegally subletted his apartment, which is insanity for me. I cannot believe he took somebody's money and said, sure, you can live in my apartment. It was illegal for him to do it, and I would assume he would know that they would find the bodies at some point anyway, but he obviously didn't care. So he took the money, and the people moved in and were quickly booted out by his landlord.
But wait a minute. Wait a minute. This just keeps getting weirder and weirder. So wait a minute. So I'm looking for a place to stay. I'm like, smells really bad. But you know what? It's a hell of a deal. Honey. You know, I mean, my wife and I just moved. I don't know that I could sell her on that deal. Hey, listen. Every place else, we'd have to pay double the rent. Sure, it smells like death in here. But come on, baby. This is the place for us to start over. That just seems like a very poorly planned idea on everybody's part.
Well, and you know, there's really low expectations in this neighborhood. He kept a pretty decent flat. I know. I mean, you know, my, my agent was taking a look at some of his pictures and sort of reading my description of him at the very beginning of this process. And she said, how is it that these women are even giving this guy the time of day? And I said, listen, in this neighborhood, he's not so bad. I mean, you're talking about a lot of servicemen who came back, really mad. And many who were unemployed. I mean, this was a really rough place to live. Gambling rings everywhere, pimps everywhere. John Christie's kind of a good catch in this scenario. I mean, he seems like somebody who's not going to hurt you. And he had money because he had a good job with the government. So, you know, it's all about setting the expectations. So yes, it is. They came in and the prosecutor asked the couple, the O'Reillys, did you not notice the smell? And they said, no, we knew that he put Lysol down right before he left. But you know, they weren't in there long enough. They got kicked out pretty quickly by the landlord. But then the landlord said to one of the neighbors, hey, why don't you go down? If you want to do some cooking in the kitchen, Christie's apartment's open until I rent it. Why don't you go down? And so the neighbor goes down with a wireless radio and decides he wants to put a radio in the kitchen so he could cook and listen to the radio. And he starts pounding on the walls and he realizes there's a hollow wall. And he pulls down the wallpaper and he sees the bodies. He shines a light, a torch as they call it. He shines a flashlight and he sees the body of one of the women in the cupboard. So it's all very creepy. It's certainly nothing you can make up.
So wait, what level was Christie on?
Ground floor.
Okay.
And it was a real weird, it was one of those Victorian, huge Victorian houses from sort of the heyday of London where all the families ended up leaving and moving to the suburbs. And so they turned this Victorian house into a tenement, you know, different levels of apartments. So there were three levels where people lived. So it was a house, but it was just awkwardly split up between three families.
And was there a basement to this underneath this house?
No,
or his level was the ground level?
His level was the ground level, right.
And he managed, with other people living there, he managed to have the bodies buried in his house and nobody else complained.
He dug the grave while his neighbors looked over the fence and say, hey, how are you doing? And he said, they said Cheerios to me. And he just waved and said, hi. He was digging the grave for one of the women he had stored in the wash house. So, I mean, I don't know how you, maybe your listeners know better than I don't know how you categorize that kind of person. I mean, certainly sociopath, not a psychopath because he knew what he was doing was wrong and he did a great job covering him up. It's just, it seems odd. He really wanted to keep them close. You know, and he did one of the creepier parts of this book is the police officer, Lynn Trevelyan, who, you know, after meeting Christie, was surprised to find himself at 10 Rillington Place a few months later in the middle of a murder investigation. And he was standing over the hole in the parlor, realizing, you know, that he had been standing near the wife. And he looked outside and one of his officers was digging in the backyard and he saw this shiny box in the dirt and he walked over and it was a tobacco, gold leaf tobacco box. And he opened up the box and there were 7 or 8 tufts of hair, private hair from women that was his trophy. He kept a trophy and he buried it in the backyard. And they tried to use those hairs to identify the different women and to kind of prove who he killed. Did he kill the neighbor? Did he not kill the neighbor? So he was a really strange, interesting man. Very strange.
Yeah, that's to say the least. All right. So they finally catch him because this whole thing crumbles quickly. When they figure his story out, talk to me about what happens to him. Does he roll over pretty quickly? Does he deny it? What happens?
Well, he doesn't deny. I mean, it's pretty hard to deny when you have three women in your cupboard and your wife under the floorboards and two in the backyard.
Yeah, but you've got a neighbor that killed, and you could play off the, maybe he got in here and did this when I wasn't home. I would have thought, you know, that would have been my first course of action, would have been trying to put it on the other killer that shared my same dwelling. So
you would have needed to be better with the timeline because the neighbor was executed – after the first two were, before the first two were killed. So wait, the first two were killed in 43, 44. The neighbor was executed in 50, and then Christie killed the others in 52 and 53. So Timothy Evans as a scapegoat would have, lived out his life several years before. No, Christie admitted to him. He used sort of some silly excuses. So with his wife, he said he wanted to put her out of her misery because she woke him up and she was choking. She had taken some barbiturates that she shouldn't have taken. And, of course, the coroner said she didn't take anything. We did an autopsy. And then with the last three women, he said that they attacked him, and it was self-defense. But, of course, there was a huge amount of carbon monoxide from the coal gas in their systems, and they had all been sexually assaulted. So, and there was – he sort of copped to the two in the backyard for some odd reason, because they were skeletons in the backyard. He could have really tried to wiggle out of those two. But he said, yeah, you know, rough sex, and it turned into this. And then the second one, I just, I kind of caught the bug, and I thought it, you know, would be interesting to see if I could get away with it again. And I think that just so many times it slipped through the cracks that he was just able to keep going. And then when he ran out of money, he had to leave, but he still tried to pick up women on the run, which is incredible. I mean, I don't know where he thought he was going to take them, because he had subletted out his apartment, but, you know, he just, it just sort of the ignorance, I don't even know what else to call it, that he had. It was really fascinating. I will say, though, that his attorney asked him to confess to basically killing everyone possible. He would have confessed to JFK had that been an option, I think, because they were trying to, you know, get an insanity defense together. And so the neighbor's wife and child, Christie, ended up confessing to about a week after he was in prison at the request of his attorney, and which is where this posthumous exoneration came from. So Timothy Evans was exonerated for killing his daughter, not his wife. He was exonerated for killing his daughter because Christie confessed. But I don't believe the confession. It was a silly confession. It didn't make any sense the way he said it went. And he testified that eventually that his attorney said confess to everyone. His attorney tried to get him to confess to a teenage girl's murder in Windsor. And Christie wasn't even in the area at the time. And Christie told the attorney, I don't kill kids. So I'm not going to confess to that. But it didn't work, you know, so he didn't get the insanity defense. And so he did become this celebrity, which is what he really wanted. So I think sort of at the end, in some ways, he got what he wanted. He was glorified. I mean, the newspaper articles are just nauseating. I mean, women wrote to him. It was incredible. Incredible, the amount of attention that the man got, certainly more than he got probably with all the years of his life up until then put together. So it was an interesting case.
That is bizarre that people – well, I guess it's not. People are still doing that today, where they're sending these love letters and attention to these murderers. And you think it's the last thing that a normal mind would do, right? To communicate with them or feel attracted to them knowing what they did. But he did get that taste. What was he like? I mean, was he a Ted Bundy kind of good looking fellow? Was he, what can you describe us, you know, describe to us as the way he presented himself?
He had, an overbite. He had a large forehead, spectacles. He was not particularly good looking, but again, all things being relative, I don't think he was completely unattractive. I think what the issue was that he was so awkward. People mentioned an awkward laugh, that he had kind of a bounce to his step that was odd. And I mentioned he was gassed with mustard gas in World War I. So he was left with this sort of prepubescent boy squeaky thing happening that I'm sure wasn't particularly attractive. He was just awkward. But I also think he was the sort of man who just faded into the wallpaper. He was not memorable. He didn't have a good or particularly bad personality. He was just sort of there. He disappeared. I think that people just remembered him sitting in the front parlor with the curtains drawn with no light on, and they could see his figure sitting in the parlor looking out the window, which is of course a Alfred Hitchcock type of feeling. And so I think that it was he was just a nondescript man who ended up with a lot more attention than he deserved because of what he did. And so I think that that's what's difficult about glorifying these serial killers, is it sort of perpetuates this idea that if they don't get attention one way, if they do something horribly enough, that they'll, you know, become infamous. And that's what he was. He was infamous. And this is what's so scary, is in London, he is certainly more well known than the Great Smog of 1952. I mean, by far. 10 Rillington Place was an infamous address, so infamous that they had to destroy the whole neighborhood. And a film was made about it. So, you know, which one of these killers deserves more attention? Certainly, I think the Smog. But, you know, in society, the serial killer is the one who gets the attention.
But these women that went missing, the prostitutes, they were irrelevant in time and space, right? I mean, nobody realized that they were missing. Nobody knew that these deaths were taking place.
Yeah, not really. I mean, it's sort of like the modern day trucker serial killer who could just pick up any women along the route, and you're never going to be able to trace him because he works along the highway. You know, I mean, it's we depend on killers who can leave a mark. And, you know, when you have somebody like Christie who picks out women who, right, I mean, they were all moms. None of them cared for their children. The children all lived with, you know, their family members. They had all lived in London and, you know, were working the streets. And working the streets in Notting Hill was really difficult for prostitutes. I mean, a lot of violent people. And so he was a really attractive option to many of them. And he groomed a lot of them, too. Some of these women he had seen multiple times. So that they would eventually trust him. But he certainly did select people who were not going to be missed. And I think that he sort of realized the mistake he made by killing Ethel, his wife, because it was for a very practical purpose. I mean, he wanted use of the flat. He didn't want to be bugged anymore. She was complaining more and more about the neighbors, about her health. And so he killed her, but the problem with Ethel was that she was missed. So he had to start doing things that he wasn't used to doing. He had to forge Christmas cards. He had to buy gifts for people and write these cards that made no sense in the hand of his wife. He changed the date on a letter that his wife had written to her sister. And you could see the change. I have the letter. You could see how he changed it from December 10th to, I think it was the 15th. And he did it all as a cover-up, and he was pretty lousy at a cover-up. I mean, anyone who really wants to cover up something is probably not going to bury people in their yard and in their house when they have police officers walking around. So, but he was able to get away with it. I mean, he started killing in 43 and ended in 53. So you're talking about a decade of killing. And if the police officers who were looking for his neighbor's wife and child had just noticed that femur, all of this would have gone away. If they had just noticed that bone, or had stepped over towards where the women were buried, he only buried them about 7 or 8 inches down once he got past the level where their bodies were. I mean, these were shallow graves where these two women were. Then he would have been caught. His wife would still be alive, and three more women would have been alive. But they didn't. But yeah, I mean, as a killer, you focus on people who aren't being searched for, it's certainly much easier to get away with it.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Did his wife ever seem? Did he ever mention that his wife ever seemed to catch on to what he was doing?
No. You know, she left him for another man early into their marriage, so she clearly had the ability to leave if she needed to leave. They ended up getting back together several years later, but she, I don't think she was sort of this strong matriarch, I don't think that they fought loudly. I think they were both sort of meek people. But I certainly don't think if she knew anything about this that she would have stayed. Absolutely. I don't think so. Particularly through the Geraldine Evans and the Burl Evans episode, because Ethel and Chris and John, actually, John Christie took care of the little girl many times when the mom would need to go work. And so that's another reason why I just can't see John Christie killing Geraldine. There would be no reason for him to kill a 13-month-old girl. Absolutely no. There's a church nearby. He could have just left her at the church. And so I think that they actually had what seemed to be a fairly decent marriage, not abusive, it seemed. But I just don't think if she had any clues, she would have stayed. There's no way.
Yeah, it would seem, well, at least you would think, but look at Gacy's wife stayed, a lot of these people, yeah. And they, you know, they all kind of had some kind of inkling there were weird things going on. I just can't get past the smell.
Well, the neighbors say that he was putting down disinfectant all the time. I mean, in the front parlor, in the back parlor. But also, I know you don't believe me, but December, January, February, March are very dry months. There was no heater on. You're talking about 20, 30, 40 degree weather. So think about, those are pretty good conditions. And there wasn't an overwhelming smell. Even, you know, Lynn Trevelyan said to me, I could smell it, but it wasn't like I was choking from it. It was just odd. And I think if it was an overwhelming smell, he might have explored it a little bit more. But Christie did a pretty good job covering it up, but he had that couple. The O'Reillys came in, looked at the flat, and said, sure, we'll sublet it. And that's with four bodies. So it couldn't have been that overwhelming. And I have a picture of Ethel's body from the National Archives where they've removed her, and she's sort of in a mummified state. He did a good job cleaning them up and wrapping them up and everything. So, you know, they were fairly well preserved from the photos that I saw. That's pretty gross. Sorry.
It's a weird, weird, dark world we live in. Hey, I can't thank you enough for joining us and discussing the book with us. We'll have a copy. Actually, if you go, ladies and gentlemen, to darknessradio.com and click on our killer deals link, it'll take you to our Amazon page where we hand select all of the books you hear from our authors and other great items that are available on that page. And every time you make a purchase through that page, a very small portion of each sale goes to help the administrative costs for this show and Beyond the Darkness. So make sure you go and get yourself the book. Right now, there's no reason. As a matter of fact, you can get just the regular copy of the book. I mean, if you want to. Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the great London smog, and the strangling of a city. They've got it for hardcover, just $13.50 on Amazon Prime. The audiobook's only $20.76. The Kindle version, just $13.99. Or, if you want the one collectible version, apparently made from angel feathers and the blood of a unicorn for ink, it's $937.50. Kate, thank you so much, and we look forward to talking to you future and hope you'll come back and share with us some more.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, Tim, it's time to take a look at the craziness that's gone on the last 2 weeks with dumb crimes and stupid criminals. Our first story takes us to a magical faraway land known as Florida. I know, hard to believe Florida, but Clearwater to be exact, where deputies in Pinellas County say an attorney was caught with his pants down while planning to record himself having sex with an inmate as part of a project to make a video called Girls in Jail. According to the sheriff's office, detectives received a tip last month that Andrew Spark was paying female inmates for sexual acts at the Pinellas County Jail in Clearwater. They say Shauna Bozzelli, a 25-year-old inmate, claimed Spark visited her in jail even though he's not her attorney. She says that Spark offered to put money in her commissary account in exchange for oral sex and bragged about meeting another inmate earlier that day. Bozzelli declined that alleged offer, but detectives later confirmed that Spark met privately with a 28-year-old inmate, Antoinette Napolitano, and met with her that same day. After investigating, deputies say the two actually had sex inside the Pinellas County Jail at least six times between June of 2017 and December of 2017. A little chained heat going on. Sheriff Bob Gulateri said Monday that Spark would begin his interview by filming Napolitano in her jail uniform and ask her to narrate sexual fantasies before filming her performing sexual acts. When they got the word that Spark was scheduled to arrive at the Pinellas County Jail to meet with Napolitano on Sunday, detectives say they entered the attorney visitation room and caught him with Napolitano just as the two were about to begin a sexual act. Spark's penis was in a fully exposed position when detectives entered the room, the sheriff noted. Spark was charged with exposure of sexual organs, introduction and possession of contraband into a county detention facility, and soliciting for prostitution. Deputies say Spark did not speak to detectives and requested an attorney. Detectives say it is possible that Spark has engaged in the same activity with additional female inmates at the Pinellas County Jail and at other jails throughout the Tampa Bay area and Central Florida, and he's now facing additional charges. Oh, I just love it when the law goes wrong. Well done, Florida. Oh, but we're not done with you yet. How Florida man wriggled a door to electrocute his pregnant wife, then changed his Facebook status to widowed before he carried out his failed plot. Oh, another genius from the southern state. A Florida man is accused of rigging his front door to his home in an attempt to electrocute his estranged pregnant wife. This is one of the most bizarre domestic violence cases I've ever seen in my career, said Flagler County Sheriff Rick Staley. Not only did this man plan to electrocute his wife, but he could have injured a deputy or any person attempting to enter this residence. Thankfully, the man was found and taken into custody before he could cause the harm he intended. Michael Scott Wilson, 32, was arrested Thursday in Knoxville, Tennessee, and charged with attempted aggravated battery on a pregnant woman and grand theft of a firearm. Police believe that he rigged electrical devices to the top door lock and lower door handle so it would electrocute whoever tried to unlock and open the front door. The rigging consisted of two chairs, a child's high chair, blue tape, a shower-type rod, electrical cords, wiring, and a car battery charger with clamps, according to the Daytona Beach News Journal. It could have caused serious bodily injury or even death. This guy is the MacGyver of the murder scene. What a heinous crime. Wilson has also stolen a firearm belonging to his wife's father from the house. He's being held on a $150,000 bond and will be extradited to Florida. It's unclear if he has an attorney. The woman's father called deputies after Wilson made suspicious statements about keeping children away from the door. Deputies found the front door barricaded with burn marks. When a deputy kicked the door, a large spark was observed. Wilson had changed his Facebook relationship status to widowed. Deputies also found pictures of a sonogram on the kitchen table, a sticky note, love letters in the bedroom, with a photo album showing Wilson and his wife together, and the wife's recently installed smart camera dumped in the toilet. He was involuntarily hospitalized for mental evaluation back in November. Holy crap, what a dark, creepy guy. All right, what else have we got going on? Oh, I know it's hard to believe. It's hard to believe, but we're going back to Florida, where a Florida woman began yelling racial slurs before pleasuring herself on an arresting officer's arm. A Florida woman pleasured herself on a police officer's arm after a bus stop encounter that involved simulated sex acts, an officer said. Between the sex acts, the woman repeated racial slurs, according to another officer. Clearwater's Nicole Shankster's sex act on a Pinellas Park officer Ashley Melher's arm ended with charges of disorderly conduct and battery on a law enforcement officer. The disorderly conduct, as described by Pinellas County Officer Cynthia Martin on the arrest report, the 5'9", 120-pound Shankster swigging Skol vodka and simulating sex acts at a 49th Street bus shelter in view of rush hour traffic. The defendant continued to verbally and physically simulate masturbation once taken into custody and was repeatedly calling a black officer the N-word while she was escorted to the marked police vehicle, the report states. Once taken to St. Petersburg General Hospital for treatment, things got real, Officer Mailer wrote. The defendant did intentionally sexually satisfy her on my left arm and lick my right arm while I was restraining her from masturbating while in police custody. I didn't even know that was a law. Shankster, 34, remains in Pinellas County Jail on $5,100 bond, just in case. Just in case she was able to come up with that $5,000, they tacked on an extra $100 just to keep that illicit beast off the streets. All right, here's something. Every time you think about the bad dates you've had, just think about them. Just sit back and think about the blind dates from hell that we all seem to have had at one point or another. Well, we're going to Houston. No, not Houston, Florida. Houston, Texas, where a woman accused of destroying 3 paintings and 2 sculptures belonging to a Houston attorney, Tony Busby, and causing hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of damage, appeared in court. Lindy Lehman, age 29, has been charged with criminal mischief. According to details that came out in court, Lehman and Busby were on a date Saturday when she became heavily intoxicated and they returned to his home. Busby believed she was too intoxicated and called an Uber driver to pick her up. She allegedly refused to leave and hid in his home. That's when Busby called a second Uber driver. Per the information read in court, Lehman was aggressive toward the second Uber driver, walked back into Busby's home and shouted, "I'm not leaving." That's when she allegedly poured red wine on his paintings and ripped them off the wall, then threw his sculptures on the ground. The paintings apparently include an Andy Warhol original. According to court documents, the resulting damage cost around $300,000. Lehman posted a $30,000 bond. Busby is a high-profile attorney who led the defense in former Texas Governor Rick Perry's abuse of power case, which was later dismissed. Busby also recently made headlines for parking a World War II tank in his River Oaks neighborhood. Boy, you think you've been on a bad date before, ruined over $300,000. $300,000 worth of art. Unbelievable. Here you go. Now, this is thinking outside the box. Not just standing on some seedy, dirty, dark corner or in the back of some bar in the bathroom trying to sell drugs. We have a California couple here. And they're charged on Tuesday after they allegedly used a drone to deliver drugs to customers while a 9-year-old girl lived in their drug-littered home, police say. The pair, Benjamin Paul Baldassare, 39, and Ashley Lauren Carroll, age 31, were charged with possession of controlled substances for sale, child endangerment, and possession of drug paraphernalia. That's from City News Service. Carroll pleaded not guilty to the charges and was held on $100,000 bail. Baldassare was expected to be arraigned on Wednesday. Police began investigating the couple's Orange Crest neighborhood in Riverside earlier this month after someone reported drugs being dropped to customers from a drone. Last Thursday, police served a search warrant at the pair's house where they found uncapped hypodermic syringes and unpacked powders believed to be fentanyl littering a bedroom. Detectives also located methamphetamine and suspected LSD-laced candies, as well as the drone used for the delivery of the illegal narcotics, police wrote on Facebook. Baldassare's 9-year-old daughter was found in a bedroom with a vape pen containing marijuana in it. The girl was placed with Riverside County Child Protective Service agents and later released to her biological mother, according to the City News Service. Baldassare and Carroll were charged in a previous unresolved drug-related case. According to court documents, Baldassare also was convicted in the past for driving under the influence of drugs and being under the influence of a controlled substance. Oh, parents, you just need to get out of this business. Stop being parents if that's what you're going to do. That is brutal. All right, let's see. As we wrap up today's dumb crimes, stupid criminals, just a handful of them here available this week. I'm sure Florida was taking time off for the holidays. We're going to go all the way to Madison, Wisconsin as we wrap up. Apparently, they are not taking the Packers being eliminated from the playoffs well in Madison, Wisconsin. Madison police say that they've arrested a hairstylist accused of snipping a 22-year-old customer's ear. Police spokesman Joel Despain says the victim told officers the hairstylist told him to stop fidgeting and moving his head before nicking his ear on Friday. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that Despain says the hairstylist then ran the clipper with the shortest attachment down the middle of the customer's head, leaving him looking a bit like Larry from the Three Stooges. And that's according to the Wisconsin State Journal. Despain says officers arrested 46-year-old Khalid A. Sabani of suspicion of mayhem and disorderly contact while while armed. Despain says Sabani told officers it was just an accident, just a simple accident. Holy cow, suspicion of mayhem. When you knowingly shave the middle of a person's hair and give them the reverse mohawk, and you are, in fact, their hairstylist. That's not mistaken. That isn't, oh, geez, did that happen? I wasn't even familiar. How did that happen? That is a legitimate gripe. You know that you did something wrong when you involve yourself in something like that. Guys, that's it for this week. It is crazy, weird crimes out there. We've got a whole new week of shows coming up for you next week, again, with True Crime Tuesday. And we've got some more dumb crimes, stupid criminals. And keep emailing me. I would love to hear from you, the listeners. If you've ever participated in just a dumb crime, what was the stupidest thing you ever stole? And how old were you when you did it? I'm always fascinated by people that don't need to steal but did anyway. Why did you do it? We can let you remain anonymous if you'd like that case. Or what are some of the other stupid things you've done criminal-wise that you'd like to actually admit to on the show, as long as it's not murder or endangerment of a child? Just let us know. You can email me, dave@darknessradio.com. I'd love to hear some of your stupid crime stories and share them with me at dave@darknessradio.com. And also, thanks again to our listeners that have always got an eye out for compelling product and shows and things that they think would be great for us, because that's where we get some of our best guests, like tonight's guest. So again, you can email me, dave@darknessradio.com. If you know of a true crime story that you think would be fascinating, historic, frightening, or just plain out bizarre for us to cover on an upcoming episode of the best in paranormal talk radio. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. This has been True Crime Tuesday.